Hello everyone. It's really nice to be back at Premier. Thank you for inviting me. Going to talk to you today about something you might not have heard a lot about, which is a subject called magnetohydrodynamics. It's a special kind of hydrodynamic systems. I'll tell you more about them as we go, but I've been working on these for past year with Jay Armas from Amsterdam and some other collaborators, which I have here. You can look at these papers if you are curious about anything which I said in the talk or anything was not clear. I'll hope that my talk will be self-contained within itself, however. Good, so this work I've been doing, I started it actually last year here at PI itself. So that's a quite nice roundabout because I do have a nice story to tell at this point, and hopefully you'll find it as interesting as I do. So what are we going to talk about today are some special systems which we find in nature, and I'll term them collectively as plasmas. What plasma is, for all intents and purposes of this talk, are charged fluids. Fluids which carry electromagnetic charge. But conventionally, you might have heard of other talks on charged fluids, but mostly what they're talking about are some charged fluids which are essentially doing their own thing on some background. So there are some background of electromagnetic fields, and your fluids might be moving on them, and you just study how they behave and their transport properties and everything. Plasmas are slightly different. Here what you do is you say that your hydrodynamic system which you're talking about is charged enough, it is strongly charged, that it can actually affect your background itself. So you're essentially trying to write down a theory in which fluid is coupled to the electromagnetic degrees of freedom, and you essentially write down a theory of electrodynamics at finite temperature, which is quite interesting in itself. Now, the only fact that you need to know about plasmas for current talk is that they have something called electric screening. And this all comes down to one fact about our universe, that we don't have magnetic monopoles. Now, because we don't have magnetic monopoles, but we do have electric monopoles. So what essentially ends up happening is that if you take a plasma, which is this charged fluid, which is strongly charged and can do anything it wants, and if you let it cool down, you let it rest, then on an average, there won't be any electric fields left and there won't be any accumulation of charges. These both will cancel each other. If there was an accumulation of charges, electric fields will make sure that they normalize themselves on large scales. And similarly, monopoles, electric monopoles will make sure that no electric fields go, like, are sustained at large enough scales. Essentially, these plasmas are electrically neutral at large scales, and they don't have any electric fields at large scales again. And the only electromagnetic component that is left in these systems are these magnetic fields or magnetic field lines. Now, I can give you some very quick throwbacks for where these systems are important. So they are the most important, like at least right now, are in solar physics or in astrophysics in general, where you model stars or galaxies or cores of planets using these plasmas, these magnetohydrodynamic systems. And again, as we probably know, that typically all these astrophysical objects are not charged. They don't have any average charge. They don't have any electric fields going around. It's all about just magnetic fields and their dynamics. And what I'm going to talk to you about today is a new view of looking at these systems where you forget about electrodynamics, you forget about all electric fields, you forget about your Maxwell's equations and everything, and you essentially look at these systems as a system of magnetic field lines. So all these systems have is they are some fluids which have some magnetic fields going around them, and you don't care where they come from, you don't care where, if you had a photon which gave rise to these magnetic fields or whatever, and you essentially write down a theory from scratch as an effective theory of these magnetic field lines. And I'm going to argue that this is good enough for everything that we do in the phenomenology of MHD. And I'll try to argue that this setup is actually quite more robust than the conventional formulation of MHD. But that's one thing. But all of this was already done when I started working on this last year. What I'm particularly interested in are some fundamental issues in these fluid systems. And the fundamental issue all boils down to this one fundamental fact about fluid dynamics that we know, like at least for past couple of decades, is that fluids, the best way to understand a fluid system is a perturbative expansion around an equilibrium configuration. You let your system go to a thermodynamic equilibrium, you don't touch it, and then you perturb it slightly, and those perturbations are essentially governed by this hydrodynamics which you're trying to describe. And for this to make sense, you need to first take your system and let it go to equilibrium. You need to first describe what these equilibrium configurations are. And it turns out that these formulation of MHD in terms of magnetic field lines, so-called string fluids, don't have a well-defined equilibrium configurations in general. In more technical terms, which I'll get to in a little bit, they do not admit a local thermal partition function, which you expect any finite temperature field theory to do. So all these technical things aside, I'll try to motivate that you can make this work if you introduce one scalar field in the theory, apart from the magnetic field lines, which I already talked about. And these scalar fields, if you remember your final years of college, I suppose, there's this, if you do these problems in magnetostatics, you can either work in terms of these vector potentials, or you can work in terms of a scalar magnetic potential, which only works for magnetostatic problems. In general, you wouldn't be able to do that if you have dynamical electric fields. But if you don't have electric fields in your system, you can talk about a magnetic scalar potential, and I'll argue that the field which you need to introduce in your system is this magnetic scalar potential. And this fixes the problems which I'll highlight in equilibrium in these string fluids. And more importantly, I'll try to make some connection with this magnetic scalar potential at finite temperature, and how can it be actually understood as some sort of spontaneous symmetry breaking and some Goldstone coming from some symmetry breaking in your system. And hopefully these things will be more clear as I go through the bulk of my talk. So I'll try to not be very ambitious in this talk, and I'll just give you a very quick outline of what I'm going to do. I won't cover most of the details, because all the details which you would need will be in 150 pages of these papers if you wanted to go back and read them. But for now, I will just acknowledge that not everyone works with hydrodynamics or MHD on a regular basis. So I'll give you a quick overview of what these systems are. Then I'll give you a quick overview of what do I mean by string fluids, and what do I mean by a formulation of this, these MHD systems in terms of string fluids. I'll outline for you what the problem in equilibrium configurations are, how can you fix them. And hopefully by the end, I will have time to tell you about some interesting stuff of how this can be related to some sort of symmetry breaking in hydrodynamic systems. So, relativistic magnetohydrodynamics. All I'm going to talk about here is some fluid which is coupled to some dynamical electromagnetic fields. Now, a fluid is essentially a system which does not have any gapless degrees of freedom, which does not have any massless degrees of freedom fundamentally. So, as you go to lower and lower temperatures, you integrate out all the massless degrees of freedom, and at the end of the day, the only thing that determines the dynamics of these systems are conservation equations. So in the current case, my fluid will have an energy momentum conservation, which is this guy, T mu nu will be my energy momentum tensor. And right now, I want to couple this fluid to some dynamical electromagnetic fields. So in addition, I have these very well-known Maxwell's equations, where I have a field tensor, divergence of it, and some matter charge currents. And I have the Bianchi identity associated with electromagnetic fields. Just the usual Maxwell's equations and the energy momentum conservation. Now these are a bunch of equations, and to make the system closed, I can pick up some dynamical fields which can be described by purely these fields, purely by these equations. Now here on top, I have four equations. I can pick up four variables which I can solve using these equations. And typically these are called hydrodynamic variables. I have three fluid velocities. I have normalized them to -1 for this talk, and I have something called fluid temperature. These two exist for no matter what fluid you talk about. In addition, you have a charge fluid, so you will have a chemical potential corresponding to these charges, which is another degree of freedom in hydrodynamics. And I have two electromagnetic fields, like the usual electric and magnetic fields. Here I have defined them with respect to the fluid velocity. If you have a preferred frame of reference in your theory, you could define the electric and magnetic fields according to that frame. But right now, it suffices if I describe them with respect to the fluid frame of reference. Just doing a quick count, I had 4 degrees of freedom, 4 equations here, I had 4 degrees of freedom in fluid velocity and temperature. usual Maxwell's equations can be solved for electromagnetic fields, which are E and B here. But typically, the matter current will be required to be identically conserved. I do not require it to be identically conserved in the hydrodynamic sense. So the divergence of del mu j mu matter equal to zero, which would be a divergence of this equation, will give you the dynamics for chemical potential. So I do have the degrees of freedom match, and I can go ahead and solve the system as I would with given some initial boundary conditions. What fluid dynamics essentially is that you say, okay, I have these dynamical fields, I have those dynamical equations, and these dynamical equations are given in terms of these two things which I do not know. There's an energy momentum tensor there, and there's a charge current there. Everything else is given in terms of these fundamental fields straight away. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to say, okay, I'll take these two currents, and I'll write the most general thing possible in terms of all the constituent fields that I talked about. Like, just that. Like, I don't know what my system is made up of. I don't know what kind of charge particles it has. I don't know anything about the microscopic field theory. And the point is, I don't care either. I'm going to just write down the most general thing possible for energy momentum tensor and charge current. And I'll call those the quote-unquote fluid constitutive relations. But, okay, in general, while doing that, you could literally write down whatever you want. So you do need some sort of organizing principle. And that organizing principle is called derivative expansion of hydrodynamics, which is essentially the fact that you are very, very near equilibrium, so things are moving very slowly. So derivatives of anything are much, much smaller than the quantities themselves. So in general, you can treat the derivative itself as a perturbative parameter, and you can arrange these quote-unquote constitutive relations in a perturbative expansion. You might know some of this already. Energy momentum tensor, this is the first two terms there are the ideal fluid part. There's an energy density, and then there's a pressure. I have the Maxwell's part in the energy momentum tensor, which is also pretty well known. In charge current, again, I have the Maxwell's part here. And then I have an ideal fluid part, which is essentially saying that charge density is flowing along the direction of the fluid flow. And in addition, I'm going to add one term, which I will need for this talk, which is a conductivity term.
P is definitely not the trace of the
p mu. P is not the trace of p mu, no. P here is what is called thermodynamic pressure.
And T is the trace of t mu.
T is neither
the temperature.
Yeah, T is the temperature. Nothing is the trace of anything here. So T is temperature, T mu is energy momentum tensor, P is the pressure, and P mu is the projection operator along against the fluid velocity. Okay. I do have a conductivity term here. This looks quite fancy. Just forget about all the details here. All that is required is that charge current will be directly proportional to electric field that is applied to your system, and the proportionality coefficient is given by the conductivity. That's all you need to know. And there are some thermodynamic relations which all these coefficients here satisfy. So epsilon, P, Q, and sigma, all of these are functions of temperature and chemical potential. Because these are the scalars in my theory above, so I can write down arbitrary scalar functions, and essentially they satisfy the quote-unquote Gibbs-Duhem equation, which is dp is s dt plus q d mu. Might be familiar to you from thermodynamics. If not, then this is just a Legendre transform of the first law of thermodynamics. And this equation here is called Euler's scaling relation, which tells you energy in terms of all the other quantities in your theory. And I need one more physical input, that conductivity of a system is always positive, no matter what physical system you're talking about. And I won't tell you where all of this is coming from, but take my word for it, that all of this comes from one single requirement, that your theory must satisfy what is known as the second law of thermodynamics, which is saying that there must always exist an entropy current whose divergence is positive definite whenever with whatever dynamics fluid is moving. And I'll again just let you go check it if you wanted to, but if you take this entropy current to be this fancy guy where S is the entropy density which is appearing there and some other term, and you can show that the divergence of entropy current is always positive as long as the conductivity is positive and all these relations are satisfied.
You're assuming that electric field is the first order of derivatives, right?
Right now, I'm not assuming anything like that. I could do that.
Looks like you do, because at least the combinations attempt is
yeah.
Activity.
So, yes. So in principle, here I have not actually invoked the derivative expansion. I'm just giving you one set of constitutive relations that work. But in general, yes, you could have more terms which are combinations of electric fields and magnetic fields and so on. In general, for example, pressure could also depend on the magnetic field square and electric field square. So I'm just giving you one set of constitutive relations that satisfy the second law of thermodynamics.
So basically you're saying this is your...
Yeah, this is my system.
MHT.
Yeah, this is my physical system of interest. Yeah.
You're not going to have...
I mean... Yeah, it's like, yes, in general, the constitutive relations can be more general than this. I'm just going to talk about this system for this talk, just because things are simple. In general, I can also have like viscosities and other kind of conductivities in this theory, but I just don't want to talk about them because this will just make things worse.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
I don't have just one more question. So whatever you're going to say, is there a natural extension of that?
Yeah, you can include all the terms you want, and there is a natural extension of all of this which is given in our papers.
Okay.
Here I'm just talking about this one conductivity term.
Very good.
Yeah.
Are you treating this as a compressible or an incompressible fluid?
No. I mean this, so...
One or the other, is it compressible or not?
It is compressible, so I'm not assuming anything about compressibility here.
Right, so I'm a little bit bothered. You've got T, which is the temperature, which is the same for the whole thing. Now you take a gas and you compress it, it heats up.
Yeah.
So what
temperature I'm talking about is, it's not like a global temperature, I'm talking about a local temperature everywhere. So yes, if I compress the fluid, the temperature might rise, but that will be governed by the dynamical equations, which is this. But like right now, all I'm doing is I'm telling you that this is the energy momentum tensor of my theory, and this is the charge current as a function of temperature.
Because it depends on position, I would expect it to have indices on it.
Indices on temperature?
Well, temperature depends on position. If I have a shock wave going through my plasma.
Yeah, but temperature is still a scalar field, right? So temperature is a field.
Right, but it's got to depend on something. You can't treat it as a constant.
No, it's not a constant. It is a field. It is a field. It depends on position. So it's T of x and time.
Right.
I mean, it is not a constant. It is a field. Which is like, at every space-time point, you can have a different temperature. And you can have it as fancy as you want. It's not a constant. It's definitely not a constant. Which is why it is coming inside a derivative here. So like the correct way to think about these guys which are inside the brackets is like fields. Just like in field theory. All of these are fields. I have three vector fields and two scalar fields.
Right. I would expect it to be... linked to things like energy density, pressure. So I would expect to talk to T mu.
Yeah, so you would expect to talk about T mu, which is that guy here.
Right, T mu has indices on it.
Yeah, T mu has indices on it, yes. But I'm saying that I am going to assume that my T mu can be expressed in terms of these fundamental
tools.
Yeah.
So, Ria, can we just stop talking and keep going with this seminar? Because it seems that we're just at Sahriya at this point. So let's move on.
It's okay, sorry.
I just had a...
Yeah.
The expression for J mu...
Yeah?
Can you say a little more about the last term, sigma times E mu minus...
Yeah, so essentially, typically when you talk about conductivity, you would only talk about sigma E mu.
Yes.
But what I'm telling you is that if you require this second law of thermodynamics to hold, the term which comes with the gradient of chemical potential also is the same coefficient, which is the electric field, which comes with the electric field. So this is just something you know in charge fluids, that conductivity term couples to this combination rather than electric field alone. So essentially saying is that the response of electric field is the same as the response of gradient of chemical potential.
Right.
That's all there is. And both of them are conductivity. Okay, so I have this system. I have just established this constitutive relation which I want to talk about. And here is one fact about them, is that I had these Maxwell's equations, which were essentially J mu equal to zero on two slides ago. And I took these set of constitutive relations and I'm going to set it to zero. Now you can set it to zero, you can this is a vector equation. I have one vector in my theory, which is fluid velocity, and I can look at this equation along the fluid velocity and perpendicular to it. And some funny things happen is that if you take this equation and you project it along the fluid velocity, you can write this equation as Q is equal to something. And similarly, if you project it against the fluid velocity, you can write it as E is equal to something. And what is interesting about these is that the right-hand side of these two equations have an explicit derivative sitting in them. This derivative here, and this derivative here. Yeah?
I'm terribly sorry, remind me that I'm completely mad. Can you go one page back, because I...
There you go.
Right, so you have an expression for the entropy current.
I do, yeah.
So there is a sigma dependence there.
Yes.
So now when you compute the divergence of the entropy current,
yeah,
there will be a derivative of sigma.
Yes, there will be. And that will be balanced by the fact that you can.
So you take that into account.
Yeah, you do take that into account.
Nothing
has. You don't have to assume anything except what is given on this slide.
It's not a constant. It's
yeah.
So does that mean that it's additional Q?
It is.
So this goes back into the counting arguments.
Yes.
So I'm happy with, you know, with five fields you have.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. Now it looks like that I have conductivities, and you told me that this whole system, you are not going to add any more.
Yes, I'm not going to add anything, and I'll justify why I'm not adding anything. Is the precisely because I have five fundamental fields in my theory, but typically you would have like an action. An action will have certain functions sitting inside them. So there are different, I have these fundamental fields, but different physical systems can depend on these fundamental fields differently. So sigma is a characteristic of the system. Sigma will be a known function of temperature and chemical potential, which will be something for a given fluid.
So there is no dynamics.
There is no dynamics. Sigma is just a known function. Yeah.
Dynamic relation.
Yeah.
Energy
impression. Yeah. Sigma will be just something which will be a given function for a given fluid.
Okay. That's good.
Yeah. Good. So I told you there was this fact that both the right hand side of these equations have one explicit derivative sitting in them. So what funny thing happens is that if you take the perturbative expansion and derivative seriously, both charge density and electric fields are zero to highest order in derivative expansion. And that is precisely the statement of what I said at the very first slide, is that this is electric field screening, is that my fluid is quote unquote neutral at hydrodynamic length scales because it is derivative suppressed. And similarly, my electric fields should be treated as one derivative order, which will come back to your question, which you were posing at previous slide, is that now I can treat electric fields as a one derivative order because Maxwell's equations tell me that they are actually one derivative order. So, okay, this is just my life right now. I have a charge density, which is one derivative order. I have an electric field, which is one derivative order. And by the way, this equation, Q will be a function of temperature and chemical potential. I can formally invert this equation if I wanted to. And that will tell me that chemical potential will be some chemical potential not of function of T plus some higher derivative terms.
Sorry. So
it's okay.
If I want to look at the system where I have strong electric fields, basically
yeah. You
are saying that I cannot formulate MHD.
Yeah, you cannot formulate it with MHD because whenever the system attains equilibrium, it will try to get rid of all the electric fields and all the charge.
It should be neutral.
Yeah. Okay, good. So we learned some things. We learned that electric field and chemical potential can be written totally in terms of all the other fields in the theory. And let me formally just write them like that. So what I can formally go back and do is I can go to my constitutive relations and eliminate any occurrence of chemical potential or electric fields from my theory. So then effectively, the only fields that are left in my theory are the fluid velocity, temperature, and magnetic field. So as I claimed, the magnetic field will be the only electromagnetic sector, which will be only field in the electromagnetic sector that is relevant. And you can write down, you can go back to your equations again. You had this energy momentum conservation. I had already used Maxwell's equations to eliminate these two guys. I had Bianchi identity, which I will write it in a fancy way. Right here, star is the Hodge-Dual operator. And I can write down both of these things, T mu and star of F mu nu, just in terms of fluid velocity, temperature, and magnetic field by doing the elimination procedure I gave above. So this is what I used as my claim in the very first slide of my talk, that entire magnetohydrodynamics can be reformulated as a theory of just magnetic field lines in addition to fluid velocity and temperature. By the way, for the most of this talk, I will assume that mu naught of T is equal to zero, just to make my life simpler. You can take it to be anything non-zero if you wanted to. We have the most general expressions in our paper. They're just much more dirty. Okay, so we argued that the plasma has some neutrality and screening going on within them, which can be used to eliminate chemical potential and magnetic fields. I'm only left with theory of magnetic field lines, whose dynamics is governed by the Bianchi identity, which tells you that the flux of magnetic field lines is conserved at long enough energies, at all scales actually. And the MHD can be recast as a theory which just have these conserved magnetic field lines as a conserved object rather than a conserved charge object. And I'll get to more of this again. And because I've already eliminated Maxwell's equations and I have reduced the number of variables I need to solve for, this is obviously a simpler system to solve. Good. Now I'm going to change my gears a little bit and talk to you about something slightly different, which are fluids with string charges. Yes.
Since we're about to change gears, can I check something? Is it correct to say that there's no assumption necessarily that the velocities are small themselves, just that in the rest frame of the fluid?
You don't need. Well, actually, you do need them to be small in a very specific sense. You need them to be small so that the derivative expansion is valid, because you need to assume that the derivatives of velocity are much, much smaller than velocity themselves. So hydrodynamics is only valid when you are just moving slightly or when you're not changing things very much.
I guess Rafael is asking whether it's relativistic.
Oh, yes, it is relativistic MHD, but in that sense, this fluid velocity does not actually mean that, so fluid velocity is an average thing. So it's an effective, so there might be a fluid which inside all the components, all the atoms might be moving as relativistically as you want. But on an average, the fluid is only moving slowly. That is all I need.
No, I don't understand this. I thought that, as you said, there is only constraint on the derivatives of the velocity.
Yeah.
Velocities themselves can be close to one.
Oh, yes. Velocities can be whatever they want. But what I'm saying is that even if velocities are small, the fluid can be very relativistic. Because it is the microscopic components whose velocity matters. So it is the microscopic components, like there can be atoms which might be moving very fast, but on an average, they might not be going anywhere at all.
You're probably thinking about some rest frame, right?
I'm talking about this, the first paragraph from Landau's book on hydrodynamics is that there are two different kind of velocities. One is a velocity of a microscopic particle, and another is the velocity of an average frame.
We have fluid elements. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So in the fluid element, at least, you know, if I turn off your magnetic field and everything, you know, u mu can be anything. As long as u mu
is minus one, and as long as its derivatives are small.
That's called derivative.
Yeah. Yes.
And so then there are also, I can look at the flows in that.
Whatever you want, as long as derivatives are small.
So you're not changing any of that?
No, nothing. As long as derivatives are small, we are all good.
That's the standard. That's
relativistic hydrodynamics. Nothing funny.
Derivatives are small in its rest frame, or derivatives are small in the lab frame? Because you might have rapid circulations or things like this.
Yeah, so I mean, I think derivatives have to be small in the fluid frame of reference.
In the fluid frame.
Yeah.
That doesn't include large.
Because you do not have any other preferred frame of reference in fluid dynamics, in relativistic fluid dynamics at least. Yeah? Okay. So, I'm going to talk to you about something slightly more fancy here, is this business about one-form symmetries and string conserved charges. There has been this paper by Cyberg, and I think David here was also on that paper, which were called generalized global symmetries. And essentially, what this is you generalize what do you mean by something being conserved. It's like, if I go back to something very basic, which we probably all know, is that if your theory has a conserved current, which is like this guy, then you can define this operator on any Cauchy slice, or in fact any space-like hypersurface, which will count the number of conserved charges on that hypersurface. And this number is conserved in a very strict sense, is that this number does not evolve in time. Modulo, nothing goes or comes out of the surfaces. So you can generalize this idea of something being conserved to these things called two-form currents. So what I have here is a current which carries two indices. I want you to like just think about this star F mu nu whenever I look at this J mu nu, but I'm just going to use J mu nu because of the generality of these arguments, is that I have some current which has two indices, and this is conserved. This happens to be conserved in your system. And if that is true, then you can define a similar operator, but this operator is now defined over codimension two hypersurfaces, codimension two space-like hypersurfaces, something like that. And what this guy is counting, roughly, is just like this guy counts the number of conserved, like charged particles in a volume, and that is conserved. This guy counts the number of strings that is passing through this area element, this codimension to hypersurface. And this conservation law means that the number of strings that are passing through this hypersurface is conserved. Modulo, nothing goes out from the edges. So like this is like the only fancy thing which I'll need in this talk. And while this is true in more generality, all I need you to think about are magnetic field lines, is that this equation can be thought of as a Bianchi identity. And in that case, this Q operator is essentially the magnetic flux. And magnetic flux going through any codimension to hypersurface is always conserved, because you cannot stop magnetic field lines because there are no magnetic monopoles in your theory. So I'm going to write down a fluid system which has these kind of conserved charges, like string conserved charges, and more formally, I will have these two-form conserved currents. So this was done by, I think first in 2014, by Schuberg, where he talked about some string fluids, but more recently in the context of MHD by Grosdonov, Hoffman, and Iqbal. And what they essentially did is that they did this fluid system, which I just talked about right before, in almost exactly the same thing, but essentially having just the energy momentum conservation. Now you also have this two-form charge conservation. So you have more equations there, and you don't have any Maxwell's equations or anything like that. It is just the conservation equations, that's it. And you again pick up some fluid variables, which you want to solve for using the system of equations. Again, fluid velocity and temperature for these guys. And I have another four equations here, and I should pick up another four variables for these. Before I do that, I just want you to notice one thing, is that this equation has a time component. And the time component of this equation will not have any time derivative because J is antisymmetric. So if mu index is T, then mu index cannot be T. So that means that the time component of this equation does not tell you anything about time evolution. It only talks about space distribution of things. It does not tell you anything about time evolution. So essentially, if I make sure that this equation is satisfied at some initial Cauchy slice, it will be satisfied at all other later times as well, because it does not change in time. So essentially, I cannot pick up four dynamical fields corresponding to these four equations. I can only pick up three. And that's precisely what these guys did. They said that I'll take one vector field, H mu. I will doubly normalize it. Like I'll normalize it to one, and I'll say that U dot H is zero. So this guy only has 2 degrees of freedom left. And I will pick up one scalar, and the scalar will be understood as a chemical potential of strings in a very rough sense. And these will be my fields, the dynamical fields of this fancy fluid which I'm talking about, like string fluids. And while I use these variables, I want you to think of H mu as a direction of these strings, where they will be parameterized by two parameters, obviously. So they are directions of these strings in space, and I have a chemical potential for these strings. Okay? Good. I'll do the exact same thing I did before. I promise this is the most technical slide of my talk. So I'm not going to go any more technical than this. I'll again write down the constitutive relations in terms of all the fundamental fields of my theory. There they are. And Again, let me give you one system which does, with one set of constitutive relations that I need for this talk. Again, I have an energy and pressure and ideal fluid part. In addition, I can add a term which is an energy momentum tensor has an anisotropy in the direction of these strings. And this J mu nu, some two-form current. I don't want you to care about what this is. I just wanted to give the expression to tell you that it can actually be worked out very precisely. And just like the thermodynamics in the previous sense, there is a very well-known thermodynamic relations for these guys as well. I have this Gibbs-Duhem equation, which is again just the Legendre transform of first law. I have an Euler equation, just like I had before. And right now, I have introduced two transport coefficients rather than one. And I just call them R perp and R parallel. And the second law requires that both of them should be positive. So like there's not much physics here, except that this is one set of constitutive relations that work. And that is the one set which I need for this talk.
Is this the most general quantum
derivative? No. Again, you can have conductivities, you can have viscosities, you can have many, many other terms. Like I think at first order, there are like 50 odd terms in this system. I just want to put these two, and that's good enough for me. Yeah?
These R's are replacing sigma, is that right? Or is sigma there?
Yeah, I mean, so they will eventually be related to sigma, which I talked about before. But right now, this is an independent system. So these R perp and R parallel are just some new functions which this fluid can admit, which this string fluid can admit.
How do you think of them?
So like how you think of them will depend on what physical application you have in mind. When I make a connection with MHD, which I did before, the two of them will be thought of as resistivities. Yeah?
So
good. Typically because there's an anisotropy due to magnetic field lines, resistivity in the two directions could be different, and which is what it parameterizes. And this is precisely what I'm talking about on this slide, is that you can go back and you can equate J mu nu with star of F mu nu and T mu nu in the two theories, and you can write down a one-to-one map between all of these things, or not really one-to-one right now, but you can write down a map between the coefficients in the two theories. I'll first tell you that the fluid velocity in the string picture is different from the fluid velocity in the MHD picture. It is related by this complicated second term. No physics there either. Temperature happens to be the same. The direction of magnetic field lines, the direction of strings happens to be the same as the direction of magnetic field lines. And this chemical potential for strings happens to be equal to the strength of the magnetic field lines. More importantly, the coefficients which I had in the string fluid picture, the pressure of a string fluid is equal to the pressure of the fluid plus half b squared. You might know that half b squared is the pressure due to electromagnetic fields in Maxwell's energy momentum tensor. Similarly, energy density will be energy density of the fluid plus half b squared, which is again the magnetic field energy density in Maxwell's equations. The quote-unquote string density is equal to, again, the strength of magnetic field lines. Entropy happens to be the same. Resistivity in the parallel direction is literally 1 over conductivity, as I expect. But in the perpendicular direction, it is a slightly more complicated function. It's given like that. Yeah?
I thought the pressure due to the magnetic field is not isotropic.
The pressure due to the magnetic
field. Are you thinking, or was it kind of?
It is not, because I have defined my pressure, and then I have taken out another component outside. So it is not, but the way I have defined it, it just works out very well like that. Okay, a quick thing to note, if sigma was positive, I will make sure that R parallel and R perp were positive as well. So this actually works at the level of positivity arguments. Another thing which I wanted to state was that right now, this mapping does not look very one-to-one. There are functions of two variables being equated to functions of one variables, but this is just because I'm talking about a very special system. In general, we have shown in our papers that the correspondence between the two theories is exactly one-to-one. String fluid is exactly equal to an MHD system.
When you make this statement, is it also extending to viscosity terms?
Extending to everything.
So everything's a parallel and...
Yeah. Yeah, so everything that Powell did, we explicitly showed that at first order it can be mapped to a spring fluid. Furthermore, we had an official second law of thermodynamics argument that it will keep working at any higher order. So this is actually an exact one-to-one correspondence. Good. And now in whatever time I have, I'll try to tell you something about equilibrium configurations, the actual problem which I had with this. So far, whatever I have told you, except some generalization of some things, I haven't told you anything new which wasn't already done 3 years ago. Two. But okay, this is the problem. And the problem is this. So whenever you have a finite temperature field theory, we know that at least in equilibrium, the finite temperature field theory can be described by a partition function. And the partition function will be given by some functional z, which is a functional of some background fields which are coupled to all the conserved charges of your theory. So if you have a conserved energy momentum tensor, you will couple it to a background metric. If you have a conserved one-form current, you will couple it to a one-form gauge field. If you have a conserved two-form current, similarly, you will couple it to a conserved two-form or two-form gauge field. And the point is that I require or I expect that no matter what my fluid is, no matter what it is doing, all the equilibrium configuration that it has can be described by a thermal partition function, which is given like that. And this is actually very general. This was done in 2012 by many different groups, and this is generally known as equilibrium partition functions of hydrodynamics. So I'm going to just use their argument, and I'll tell you just in one line what is the requirement. The requirement is that this partition function should be invariant in a time-independent symmetry transformations of the background fields. What do I mean by that? Is that I can allow for a time-independent diffeomorphism. L, this guy, is a fancy Lie derivative. And time-independent gauge transformations. One-form gauge field transforms just like the usual one-form gauge transformation, but a two-form gauge field can transform as this D of a one-form gauge transformation. And what essentially ends up happening is that you will require that your partition function is invariant under these transformations, no matter what you do. And this is a statement about symmetries. So good. Furthermore, one more thing, that in fluid dynamics, you expect that this partition function will be a local functional of all of these background fields, because you expect that all the other massive degrees of freedom have been integrated out while you reach the hydrodynamic setting, and there are no other gapless degrees of freedom left in your theory. So in equilibrium, your partition function is just given by some local integral of all the background fields, just something like that. And all of this is coming directly from these papers. Just to give you a quick example, you can generate usual charged fluids by this very argument. You can show that at zeroth order in derivatives, there are only two components of metric and gauge field that do not transform under this transformation, which is G00. Which is, you can show that G00 is a scalar under diffeomorphism. So it is actually gauge covariant. Similarly, A0 only will translate by time derivative of lambda under a gauge transformation, which is also a scalar, because I'm not allowing for time dependent gauge transformations. So your partition function can be any arbitrary function of G00 and A0. And you can take this partition function, vary it with respect to G and A. That will give you energy momentum tensor and charge current. Compare it to your fluid constitutive relations, and you can show that all the equilibrium configurations are given by this, which is like very expected. Your fluid velocity is nothing but something, is just time direction. All the fluid velocities are zero in equilibrium. Your temperature is just some constant all over, and your chemical potential is a constant all over. And these are equilibrium configurations for ordinary charged fluid dynamics. And this works in much more generality, but all I need is this right now. The problem is that this does not work for one-form fluids. The problem is essentially is that A0 was a scalar under gauge transformation, but B is an antisymmetric two-form. B00 is identically zero. B0i, on the other hand, translates with a time derivative as well as a space derivative. So this is actually not gauge invariant. So you cannot make any gauge invariant scalar out of a two-form gauge field, as you did for a one-form gauge field. So at highest order in derivatives, the partition function is just a functional of G00, which is not good because we know this does not generate spring fluids, this generates ordinary charged fluids as a special case of the above partition function. So the problem was that we sort of realized that this is not going to work straight away, is that you cannot generate string fluids as using a thermal partition function. Now this problem was already realized by Prozanov, Iqbal, and Hoffman. And their solution to this problem was slightly different. They essentially claimed that, okay, this is fine. We will not expect the partition function to work on arbitrary backgrounds. It will only work on backgrounds which also have a space-like isometry. So which are time independent, but are also independent in one space direction. And in those special cases, they could come up with some partition functions that worked. But in general, there were a lot of problems in those configurations. And more fundamentally, there is no reason to expect that you can only attain equilibrium when you couple it to a metric which is also independent in one space direction. So just as some technicalities, the bottom line is that the partition function doesn't work. And you have to find a way for it to essentially work. And without telling you much about how it comes about, I'll just tell you how can it be actually made to work, is that the same people who wrote down a partition function for ordinary fluids also wrote down a partition function for something called a superfluid. And how it was different from ordinary fluids were that these were fluids which were also charged, but in addition to the usual chemical potential and fluid velocity, they had this fancy thing called a superfluid velocity in their constitutive relations. And this is very similar to spring fluids in the sense that there's an anisotropy which is introduced by the superfluid velocity. And if you were to write down partition functions for these systems, or you try to write down partition functions for these systems by just doing the same argument I was saying before, you would end up arguing that this partition function should generate superfluids as well as the ordinary charged fluids, which is obviously not true because this only generates zero form charged fluids, not superfluids. And the resolution they had for this problem was that they realized that there is a quote-unquote non-hydrodynamic degree of freedom in the theory, which is a scalar condensate, which comes about due to a spontaneous symmetry breaking. And that condensate actually is massless because it's a Goldstone, and that does not get integrated out when you go to low energies. So your partition function should actually be given as a path integral over that condensate, which is this guy here. And if you do introduce this condensate, you can show that you can actually write down a partition function very nicely. And it happens to be this. I don't need to go into the details, but the bottom line is that this partition function works, and this generates superfluids, and this generates all equilibrium configurations of a superfluid. So I'm going to essentially take this at its face value and argue that the reason it is not working, the reason my partition function did not generate string fluids was that there was a non-hydrodynamic degree of freedom in my theory, which I couldn't see straight away. I needed to know something about the system to know what this other hydrodynamic degree of freedom is. But based on the phenomenology of what works, I'll tell you precisely what works. What works is that if I introduce a scalar field in equilibrium, which has this weird transformation property, is that under a one-form gauge transformation, this guy translates with the time component of the gauge transformation. This is a very weird field. This does not really correspond to anything nice as of now. But if you introduce this field in your theory, then you can show that you can write down an equilibrium partition function for string fluids, and that exactly generates all equilibrium configurations of string fluids. No problems at all. And we also showed that it will keep working at arbitrary high orders. It will keep working in the presence of any sort of transport coefficients you put in your theory. So essentially, all I'm saying is that there is a scalar field in your theory, which is non-hydrodynamic, and you need to introduce it for the thermal partition functions to make sense. And once you go ahead and you take it more seriously, you will find out that all the equilibrium configurations in MHD are given by, again, fluid velocities aligned along the time direction. Temperature is just T0. And these two string variables, h mu was direction of strings and y pi was the chemical potential, is given by this scalar field here. And scalar field itself is described by its classical equation of motion, which is you take this and you vary it with respect to phi and you set it to zero, at least classically. It will get quantum corrections, obviously. And this guy, the highest order in the derivative expansion, is just given like that. And this is, I mean, it looks very compact. It is not a very nice equation, but this equation, all it is telling you is that there is one equation, one single equation for the scalar field phi. You solve this equation, you put it back there, and you can find all the equilibrium configurations of r pi and h. Just a throwback again, I told you r pi was the strength of magnetic field lines, and h was a direction. So this B field is actually just given by the derivative of phi, and which makes the connection that phi can be thought of as a magnetic scalar potential for this particular system. This works here. This does not work if you introduce any more terms in your constitutive relations. And you take this at more generality. This phi being interpreted as a scalar potential does not hold anymore. But what is still true is that you need a scalar field in your theory for things to work. Good. So I told you that equilibrium configurations of string fluids are controlled by one scalar differential equation, which is this equation here. What did I do? And good. Ordinarily, to find equilibrium configurations in MHD, you will have to solve all the Maxwell's equations. But right now, I've showed that you just solve this one scalar equation and you're done. You have all the equilibrium configurations you need in MHD, which if you are working in solar physics or you're working in accretion disks of black holes, is a very nice thing to have, because otherwise you end up using some very, I would say, unnatural assumptions like force-free electromagnetism, which are only valid in certain regime, are not actually valid all the way to where they're applied. But like if you work in this setup and you only have this one scalar equation, then you can actually, it actually leads to a lot of practical benefits, which some of them are actually given in our paper. But all I'm trying to tell you is that you do need that one extra scalar field for things to work. And then MHD makes sense. The scalar field is constrained by this equation, but otherwise it is not constrained at all.
So we're doing equilibrium now, is that right?
Right now it is just equilibrium. So I'm trying to find equilibrium configurations. Yeah.
So if you think of the accretion disk, for example.
Yeah.
You call it equilibrium if it's a stationary solution.
Yeah.
The velocities might in fact be fairly large.
They could be very fairly large. Yes.
That's what I was wondering about.
Yeah. So velocities could be fairly large, yes.
It's just that in the rest frame of the...
of the fluid, the gradients will be small.
Of the velocity.
Will be small, yes. Yeah. Okay. So, good. That is essentially the problem and its solution, which is this one scalar field. Now, I think I have 5 minutes, I suppose, and I'll tell you some nice things. 10?
7.
Okay. Let's see if I can do it in the 7. So I'll tell you something about what the scalar field is and what is at least one way of how you can understand this field. I showed that, or I argued that this field phi has this should have this transformation property for things to work. But that was in equilibrium. If I take these things out of equilibrium, how do I make sense of this field anymore? And obviously, there's one very good generalization is that I can just take this contraction with the fluid velocity to isolate the time component of the gauge transformation. There's this guy. And similarly, this equation, which was telling me that in equilibrium, var pi and h were given by this gradient of phi, I can generalize it out of equilibrium by saying that var pi and h have some field mu, which actually vanishes in equilibrium. And other than that, they're given by the divergence of the scalar field phi again. So, what I'm doing here, I'm saying that out of equilibrium, var pi h is given by this combination, such that in equilibrium, phi is given by just the phi which I gave before, and mu is essentially zero in equilibrium. So mu is what I would call a hydrodynamic degree of freedom because it freezes in equilibrium, while phi is a non-hydrodynamic degree of freedom because it does not freeze in equilibrium. It has some non-trivial configurations. Some interesting fact about this mu, it is not gauge invariant, and I'll just let you check that. And it is important that it is not gauge invariant because it is not gauge invariant, it has only 3 fundamental physical degrees of freedom, not 4. So remember, initially I said that I could write down a fluid with just 7 degrees of freedom, 4 in fluid velocity and 3 for the other equation. I can write down the exact same fluid with these degrees of freedom, fluid velocity, temperature, and this one from chemical potential. And we show that if you write down a fluid, a one-form fluid with these degrees of freedom, rather than the one which I introduced before, then there is no problem in partition functions. Partition functions works without any introduction of a scalar field. And no matter what constitutive relations you write here, you can always write down a partition function, a thermal partition function that works. So that, for that reason alone, we call these the symmetry unbroken or ordinary phase of one-form hydrodynamics. While when this phi field is present, I call them the superfluid phase. It's not exactly superfluid phase, it is one of the superfluid phases. I'll argue that string fluids have two superfluid phases in them. And what I mean by that is that, okay, I introduce this scalar field in my theory. That is one additional degree of freedom. I need an additional equation of motion. If you remember superfluids, then there is this equation called the Josephson equation, which tells you that the phase difference along the direction of the fluid flow is given by the chemical potential. It's something that comes from condensed matter theory, and in general, you can actually also prove it within hydrodynamics. I have done this in this paper in 2016, but using the exact same arguments, you can show that this new scalar field phi should have this equation of motion, which just based on symmetries, that's the only thing you can actually write down. And you can also show that this equation is essentially telling you that u dot h is zero. So previously I argued that u dot h, I just took it to be zero as a choice, but actually you can understand u dot h being zero as an equation of motion for this field phi. And just to make a connection with what people typically mean when they say a symmetry broken or a superfluid phase of one-form hydrodynamics, they say that there exists a vector condensate rather than a scalar condensate, which transforms, which translates essentially under a one-form gauge transformation like that. And this phi field is nothing but the velocity component. It's a component along the velocity of this vector condensate. So these string fluids are fluids which do not have their symmetry entirely broken. They have their one-form symmetry only broken along the direction of the fluid flow, while it is unbroken in all the other three directions, essentially. So this is going to be my claim, essentially, that one-form hydrodynamics or string fluids or MHD can be understood as a spontaneously broken phase of a fluid with a one-form symmetry. It is different from an entirely broken phase because you don't introduce a vector condensate, but the symmetry is still broken in the sense that you need a non-hydrodynamic mode in equilibrium, and which can be understood as a time component of a vector condensate. But to make things actually more physical, you would probably want to introduce an order parameter which can distinguish between these different phases of the theory. If you know this, in ordinary superfluids and ordinary fluid systems, the condensate, one of the order parameters can be this vertex operator, which is the exponential of some phase operator, some condensate phi. And the expectation value of this being zero or non-zero in a phase tells you if your fluid is in a superfluid phase or a non-superfluid phase, ordinary phase. Similarly, there has been arguments that if you have a vector condensate in your theory, you can compute loops, like two loops, and essentially you can talk about some loops and you can integrate this vector condensate along those loops, and you can see if what is the behavior of this this expectation value as the loop is large. And if this goes as the perimeter of the loop, I think the symmetry is completely broken, and if it goes as the area of the loop, symmetry is unbroken. Some mumbo jumbo which works, but the point is that this order parameter distinguishes between the phase where the symmetry is entirely broken and the phase where the symmetry is either partially broken or not broken. This does not give me an order parameter for when symmetry is partially broken, as I'm claiming. And I'll propose an order parameter for this guy whenever I am in equilibrium. In equilibrium, it's easy. In equilibrium, I know that I can go to the Euclidean time formulation of my theory, the Matsubara formulation of thermal field theories. And just like I did Tuft or Wilson loop here. In Euclidean field theory, I can compute a Polyakov loop for the same vector Goldstone. In this Polyakov loop, you can do some manipulation and it actually gives you this expectation value. But in equilibrium, you're computing the expectation value of this phi zero operator, the vertex operator of this phi zero. And I haven't done this calculation. I'm proposing that this expectation value should distinguish between symmetry broken and unbroken phases in partially broken and unbroken phases in one-form hydrodynamics. But more importantly, you want to do this out of equilibrium as well. So out of equilibrium, you can again do the very same substitution. You start with this vertex operator. You promote it to something like that, where the zero component can be given by contraction with the fluid velocity. And this is essentially, by definition, just this vertex operator. And the computation of this vertex operator should tell you if the phase, the theory which you have has a symmetry, has its one-form symmetry unbroken or is partially broken. And just to make some connection with some existing work, there has been a paper a couple of months ago by Glorioso and Sean at MIT, Chicago. And what they did is they wrote down an effective theory, an effective action formalism for hydrodynamics, for magnetohydrodynamics. This is a work which, this is essentially built up on the work of Sean and some other collaborators and some other people as well, like Mukund and his collaborators and Jensen and his collaborators. They have been trying to write down an effective action for hydrodynamics, but you can write down a similar effective action for magnetohydrodynamics as well. And they did it in the string fluid formulation. And this expectation value which I'm talking about it wouldn't be easy, but in principle, it should be computable with their computation. And you should be able to tell if the symmetry is actually unbroken or unbroken in the phase. So that's pretty much all I have to say. The recap of what I just told you would essentially be just that magnetohydrodynamics can be understood as a fluid with some stringy degrees of freedom. These fluids have 7 hydrodynamic and 1 non-hydrodynamic degrees of freedom in the theory. And this non-hydrodynamic degree of freedom, at least in the Euclidean field theory, can be understood as some sort of spontaneous symmetry breaking. But even outside of equilibrium, just the symmetry structure and existence of these fields motivate that there is some sort of symmetry breaking going on in the theory, and probably we need to better understand what this is. I only talked about some very small sector of what our paper had to offer, which I stayed in this left of this theory. In general, the structure of one-form fluids and one-form superfluids is much more rich, and there's all of this stuff going on. I could tell you later about some of it if you are interested. But the idea being that there are a lot more interesting stuff which you could be looking at. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for speaker?
Yeah.
So sometimes you can understand the scale of and all the parameters for spontaneous symmetry breaking, isn't it also exceptional values of properties of magnetic effects? Elongated theory, standard elongated theory.
Yes.
Then I have convex condensate. Don't I get the proof of the lecture?
Yeah, so you can talk about Tuft operators. The Tuft operator is essentially Tuft or a Wilson operator, right? Which is essentially just this guy, right? This one.
Yeah, this can be expressed. And this question was, what is this in terms of the region of
I think that actually if you compute the expectation value of this operator, this will not distinguish, this will not tell you that the symmetry is actually broken. Because this operator is essentially telling you the loop, how the behavior of the loops is. So if for large loops, what happens? And I expect that because the symmetry is not actually completely broken, it is only broken in the quote unquote time direction. the large loop behavior of these operators will essentially, like with that you will essentially argue that the symmetry is not broken. And all I'm trying to say is that this operator is not suitable to actually tell you if the symmetry is broken or not broken. You have to come up with some other operator which will tell you this.
So my conclusion is, I told that, so if you said this stuff about the thermodynamics, mm-hmm. it's a symmetry
swing fluid.
So when you want to ask if a certain system has compound symmetry breaking, do you refer to the thermodynamic system or?
Yeah, so if I say that string fluids have their symmetry spontaneously broken, I'm essentially saying that MHD has its symmetry spontaneously broken as well. So on physical grounds, this will be a statement about MHD. So the point will be that typically there has been arguments that, like obviously we know that when there are dynamical charges going on in the theory, my magnetic part of the symmetry, the magnetic part of the uniform symmetry cannot be spontaneously broken. And what I'm trying to claim is that when you actually heat up the theory and take it to finite temperature, then yes, your symmetry is not entirely broken, but just because you took the theory to finite temperature, you had this preferred time direction in your theory now, and you pick up a preferred component of the Goldstone, and this preferred component of the Goldstone actually it actually condensates. So even though at zero temperature, your magnetic symmetry is not broken at all, at finite temperature, the time component of this one-form symmetry gets broken. That will be my idea. Now, obviously, one needs to actually compute that operator which I'm proposing and actually check if this is true. But I would say that like something like that must be true, because if there was no symmetry breaking going on, if there were no gapless operators, there were no gapless fields in your theory, then I should be able to write down a thermal partition function without introducing any non-hydrodynamic modes.
I have a couple of questions.
Yes.
So the first, if this is off base or not, but there's some similarity. If you just think of a fluid, never mind MHD.
Yeah.
Then you can introduce velocity potentials for the motion.
Yes, you can.
There's some connection between those velocity potentials and your scalar field.
I am not entirely sure, because my reason for introducing these potentials, the scalar field, is that I wasn't able to write down a partition function for this theory. So I wasn't able to write down equilibrium configuration.
I think it might be connected, because the reason you need these velocity potentials is because you can't take the Eulerian variables of the fluid and vary them freely in an action principle and get the equations of motion to come out.
Yeah.
There's a constraint on the possible variations if you want.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
And the velocity potentials, I think their necessity can be traced directly to the constraint on the variation. So it's just reminiscent. I don't know.
I think I understand what you're talking about. So in all these effective action formalisms, you treat some fundamental fields, you trade them for fluid velocity. There are these coordinate fields, people are calling them these days, but I think they were Eulerian fields for hydrodynamics before that. But I think this is actually fundamentally different, because those fields actually do not show up in equilibrium. They freeze in equilibrium. And so those are genuinely thermal degrees of freedom. This phi is not a thermal degree of freedom, because if it was a thermal degree of freedom, in equilibrium it would freeze out.
And second question, when you talk about expectation value, is that in some ensemble of classical fluctuation?
It will be an ensemble of statistical fluctuation. It will be an ensemble. Classical statistical fluctuation. So, I mean, just tree level diagrams, but in a finite temperature state.
So, how do you generate this ensemble? Is it from
I would be honest, I know there has been at least one paper where Sean Hartnoll was doing something. He was computing some statistical loop diagrams, but I do not know myself how to actually do that. But I am aware that it can be done. So which is all I was trying to say here. Like, I am trying to right now actually try to understand how would you actually compute this expectation value, but it's slightly more complicated than just writing down that operator. Yeah?
Is that line defect just literally Wilson line defect?
That is literally just Wilson line. That's not literally just that. Yeah, phi is just the magnetic photon, and that is just literally just the Wilson line.
There are no more questions, then I suggest we wrap it up and thank Akash again.
Oh, thank you very much.